Second Treatise of Government by John Locke, first published in 1689. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Chapters 1 through 4. In my first treatise of government, I showed that no rulers now on earth can derive the faintest shadow of authority from the supposed source of all human political power, namely, Adam's private dominion and paternal rule. So if you don't want to imply that all government in the world is the product purely of force and violence, and men live together only by the same rules as the lower animals, where strength settles every issue, and so lay a foundation for perpetual disorder and mischief, riots, sedition, and rebellion, you will have to find another account of the beginnings of government, another source for political power, and another way of settling who ought to have it. For this purpose, I think it may be worthwhile to state what I think political power is, so that the power of a government official over a subject can be distinguished from that of a father over his children, a master over his servant, a husband over his wife, and a lord over his slave. Because sometimes one man has all these different powers. We can get clearer about how the powers differ by looking at the different relationships in which the man stands, as ruler of a commonwealth, father of a family, and captain of a galley. So, I take political power to be a right to make laws, with the death penalty and consequently all lesser penalties, for regulating and preserving property, and to employ the force of the community in applying such laws, and defending the commonwealth from external attack, all this being only for the public good. Chapter 2. The State of Nature. To understand political power correctly, and derive it from its proper source, we must consider what state all men are naturally in. In this state, men are perfectly free to order their actions, and dispose of their possessions and themselves, in any way they like, without asking anyone's permission, subject only to limits set by the law of nature. It is also a state of equality, in which no one has more power and authority than anyone else. For it is simply obvious that creatures of the same species and status, all born to the same advantages of nature and to the use of the same abilities, should also be equal in other ways, with no one being subjected to or subordinate to anyone else. Unless God, the Lord and Master of them all, were to declare clearly and explicitly his wish that some one person be raised above the others, and given an undoubted right to dominion and sovereignty. The judicious Richard Hooker regards this natural equality of men as so obvious and unquestionable that he bases on it men's obligation to love one another, on which he builds their duties towards each other, from which in turn he derives the great maxims of justice and charity. Here are his words.
A similar natural inducement has led men to realize that they have as much duty to love others as to love themselves. Things that are equal must be measured by a single standard. So if I inevitably want to receive some good, indeed as much good from every man as any man can want for himself, how could I expect to have any part of my desire satisfied if I am not careful to satisfy the similar desires that other men are bound to have? To offer them anything inconsistent with their desire will be to grieve them as much as it would grieve me, so that if I do harm, I must expect to suffer, because there is no reason why others should show more love to me than I have shown to them. Thus, my desire to be loved as much as possible by my natural equals gives me a natural duty to act towards them with the same love. Everyone knows the rules. Natural reason has laid down for the guidance of our lives on the basis of this equality between ourselves and those who are like us.
But though this is a state of liberty, it isn't a state of license in which there are no constraints on how people behave. A man in that state is absolutely free to dispose of himself or his possessions, but he isn't at liberty to destroy himself, or even to destroy any created thing in his possession, unless its destruction is required for some nobler purpose. The state of nature is governed by a law that creates obligations for everyone, and reason, which is that law, teaches anyone who takes the trouble to consult it that, because we are all equal and independent, no one ought to harm anyone else in his life, health, liberty, or possessions. This is because we are all the work of one omnipotent and infinitely wise Maker. We are all the servants of one sovereign Master, sent into the world by His order to do His business. We are all the property of Him who made us, and He made us to last as long as He chooses, not as long as we choose. We have the same abilities and share in one common nature, so there can't be any rank ordering that would authorize some of us to destroy others, as if we were made to be used by one another, as the lower kinds of creatures are made to be used by us. Everyone is obliged to preserve himself, and not opt out of life willfully. So for the same reason, everyone ought, when his own survival isn't at stake, to do as much as he can to preserve the rest of mankind. And except when it's a matter of punishing an offender, no one may take away or damage anything that contributes to the preservation of someone else's life, liberty, health, limb, or goods, so that all men may be held back from invading the rights of others, and from harming one another, and so that the law of nature aiming at the peace and preservation of all mankind may be obeyed. The enforcement of that law, in the state of nature, is in every man's hands, so that everyone has a right to punish lawbreakers as severely as is needed to hinder the violation of the law. For the law of nature, like every law concerning men in this world, would be futile if no one had power to enforce it, and thereby preserve the innocent and restrain offenders. And in the state of nature, if anyone may punish someone for a wrongdoing, then everyone may do so. That is how, in a state of nature, one man comes to have a legitimate power over another. It is not an unconditional power, allowing him to use a captured criminal according to the hot frenzy or unbridled extremes of his own will. It is only a power to punish him, so far as calm reason and conscience say it is proportionate to his crime, namely, as much punishment as may serve for reparation and restraint. For those two are the only reasons why one man may lawfully harm another, which is what we call punishment. By breaking the law of nature, the offender declares himself to live by some rule other than that of reason and common fairness, which is the standard that God has set for the actions of men, for their mutual security. So he becomes dangerous to mankind, because he has disregarded and broken the tie that is meant to secure them from injury and violence. This is an offence against the whole human species, and against the peace and safety that the law of nature provides for the species. Now, every man, by the right he has to preserve mankind in general, may restrain and, if necessary, destroy things that are noxious to mankind, so he can do to anyone who has transgressed that law as much harm as may make him repent having done it, and thereby deter the transgressor, and by his example deter others from doing the same. For this reason, every man has a right to enforce the law of nature and punish offenders. No doubt this will seem a very strange doctrine to some people, but before they condemn it, I challenge them to explain what right any king or state has to put to death or otherwise punish a foreigner for a crime he commits in their country. The right is certainly not based on their laws, through any permission received from the announced will of the legislature. For those laws don't reach a foreigner. They aren't addressed to him. And even if they were, he is not obliged to listen. To an Indian, those who have the supreme power of making laws in England, France, or Holland are merely like the rest of the world, men without authority. So if the law of nature didn't give every man a power to punish offences against it in the way he soberly thinks appropriate in the given case, I don't see how the judiciary of any community can punish someone from another country, because they can't have any more power over him than every man can naturally have over another. As well as the crime that consists in violating the law and departing from the right rule of reason, crime through which a man becomes so degenerate that he declares that he is deserting the principles of human nature and becoming vermin, there is often transgression in which someone harms another particular person. In the latter case, the harmed person has, in addition to the general right of punishment that he shares with everyone else, a particular right to seek reparation from the person who harmed him, and anyone else who thinks this is just may also join with the injured party and help him to recover from the offender such damages as may make satisfaction for the harm he has suffered. So there are two distinct rights: the right that everyone has to punish the criminal so as to restrain him and prevent such offences in future, and the right that an injured party has to get reparation. Now, a magistrate, who by being magistrate has the common right of punishing put into his hands, can by his own authority cancel the punishment of a criminal offence, in a case where the public good doesn't demand that the law be enforced. But he can't cancel the reparation any private man is owed for the damage he has received. The only one who can do that is the person who has been harmed. The injured party has the power of taking for himself the goods or service of the offender, by right of self-preservation. And everyone has a power to punish the crime so as to prevent its being committed again, by the right he has of preserving all mankind and doing everything reasonable that he can to that end. And so it is that in the state of nature, everyone has a power to kill a murderer, both to deter others from this crime by the example of the punishment it draws, and also to secure men from future crimes by this criminal. He has renounced reason, the common rule and standard God has given to mankind, and by the unjust violence and slaughter he has committed on one person, he has declared war against all mankind, so that he can be destroyed as though he were a lion or a tiger. This is the basis for the great law of nature. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. Cain was so fully convinced that everyone had a right to destroy such a criminal, that after murdering his brother he cried out, "Anyone who finds me will slay me." So plainly was this law written in the hearts of all mankind. For the same reason, a man in the state of nature may punish lesser breaches of the law of nature. By death, you may ask? I answer that each offence may be punished severely enough to make it a bad bargain for the offender, to give him reason to repent, and to terrify others from offending in the same way. Every offence that can be committed in the state of nature may also be punished in the state of nature, and punished in the same way, as far as possible, as it would be in a commonwealth. I don't want to go into the details of the law of nature or of its punitive measures, but I will say this much. It is certain that there is a law of nature, which is as intelligible and plain to a reasonable person who studies it, as are the positive laws of commonwealths. It may even be plainer, that is, easier to understand, than are the fancies and intricate theoretical contrivances of men who have tried to find words that will further their conflicting hidden interests. For that is what has gone into the devising of most of the legislated laws of countries. Really, such laws are right only to the extent that they are founded on the law of nature, which is the standard by which they should be applied and interpreted. To this strange doctrine of mine, namely that in the state of nature everyone has the power to enforce the law of nature, I expect this objection to be raised. It is unreasonable for men to be judges in their own cases, because self-love will bias men in favour of themselves and their friends. And on the other side, hostility, passion, and revenge will lead them to punish others too severely. So nothing but confusion and disorder will follow. And that is why God has, as he certainly has, established government to restrain the partiality and violence of men. I freely allow that civil government is the proper remedy for the drawbacks of the state of nature. There must certainly be great disadvantages in a state where men may be judges in their own case. Someone who was so unjust as to do his brother an injury will, we may well suppose, hardly be so just as to condemn himself for it. But I respond to the objector as follows. If the state of nature is intolerable, because of the evils that are bound to follow from men's being judges in their own cases, and government is to be the remedy for this, let us do a comparison. On the one side, there is the state of nature. On the other, there is government, where one man, and remember that absolute monarchs are only men, commands a multitude, is free to be the judge in his own case, and can do what he likes to all his subjects, with no one being allowed to question or control those who carry out his wishes, and everyone having to put up with whatever he does, whether he is led by reason, mistake, or passion. How much better it is in the state of nature, where no man is obliged to submit to the unjust will of someone else, and someone who judges wrongly, whether or not it is in his own case, is answerable for that to the rest of mankind. It is often asked, as though this were a mighty objection, where are there, wherever were there, any men in such a state of nature? Here is an answer that may suffice in the meantime. The world always did and always will have many men in the state of nature, because all monarchs and rulers of independent governments throughout the world are in that state. I include in this all who govern independent communities, whether or not they are in league with others. For the state of nature between men isn't ended just by their making a pact with one another. The only pact that ends the state of nature is one in which men agree together mutually to enter into one community and make one body politic. The promises and bargains involved in bartering between two men on a desert island, or between a Swiss and an Indian in the woods of America, are binding on them, even though they are perfectly in a state of nature in relation to one another. For promise-keeping belongs to men as men, not as members of society, that is, as a matter of natural law, not positive law. To those who deny that anyone was ever in the state of nature, I oppose the authority of the judicious Richard Hooker, who writes,
"The laws of nature bind men absolutely, just as men, even if they have no settled fellowship, no solemn agreement among themselves about what to do and what not to do. What naturally leads us to seek communion and fellowship with other people is the fact that on our own we haven't the means to provide ourselves with an adequate store of things that we need for a life fit for the dignity of man. It was to make up for those defects and imperfections of the solitary life that men first united themselves in politic societies. And I also affirm that all men are naturally in the state of nature, and remain so until they consent to make themselves members of some political society. I expect to make all this very clear in later parts of this discourse."
Chapter 3. The State of War. The state of war is a state of enmity and destruction. So when someone declares by word or action, not in a sudden outburst of rage, but as a matter of calm, settled design, that he intends to end another man's life, he puts himself into a state of war against the other person, and he thereby exposes his life to the risk of falling into the power of the other person, or of anyone who sides with him in this quarrel. For it is reasonable and just that I should have a right to destroy anything that threatens me with destruction, because the fundamental law of nature says that men are to be preserved as much as possible, and that when not everyone can be preserved, the safety of the innocent is preferable. In line with this, I may destroy a man who makes war on me, or has revealed himself as an enemy to my life, for the same reason that I may kill a wolf or a lion, because such men are not under the ties of the common law of reason, have no rule except that of force and violence, and so may be treated as beasts of prey. dangerous creatures that will certainly destroy me if I fall into their power. So it comes about that someone who tries to get another man into his absolute power thereby puts himself into a state of war with the other, for such an attempt amounts to a declaration of a plan against the life of the other man. If someone wants to get me into his power without my consent, I have reason to conclude that he would use me as he pleased when he had got me there, and would destroy me if he wanted to. For no one can want to have me in his absolute power unless it's to compel me by force to something that is against the right of my freedom, i.e. to make me a slave. To be sure of my own survival, I must be free from such force, and reason tells me to look on him, the person who wants me in his power, as an enemy to my survival, wanting to take away the freedom that is my protection. So someone who tries to enslave me thereby puts himself into a state of war with me. Someone who wants to take away another's freedom must be supposed to have a plan to take away everything else from the person, because freedom is the foundation of all the rest, and that holds in a commonwealth as well as in the state of nature. This makes it lawful for me to kill a thief who hasn't done me any harm or declared any plan against my life, other than using force to get me in his power, so as to take away my money or whatever else he wants. No matter what he claims to be up to, he is using force without right to get me into his power. So I have no reason to think that he won't, while I am in his power, take everything else away from me as well as my liberty. So it is lawful for me to treat him as someone who has put himself into a state of war with me, that is, to kill him if I can, for that is the risk he ran when he started a war in which he is the aggressor. This is the plain difference between the state of nature and the state of war. Some men, notably Hobbes, have treated them as the same, but in fact they are as distant from one another as a state of peace, goodwill, mutual assistance and preservation is distant from a state of enmity, malice, violence, and mutual destruction. A state of nature, properly understood, involves men living together according to reason, with no one on earth who stands above them all, and has authority to judge between them. Whereas in a state of war, a man uses, or declares his intention to use, force against another man, with no one on earth to whom the other can appeal for relief. It is the lack of such an appeal that gives a man the right of war against an aggressor, not only in a state of nature, but even if they are both subjects in a single society. If a thief has already stolen all that I am worth, and is not a continuing threat to me, I may not harm him, except through an appeal to the law. But if he is now setting on me to rob me, even if it's just of my horse or my coat, I may kill him. There is the law, which was made for my protection, but there is no time for it to intervene to save me from losing my goods, and perhaps losing my life. And if I lose that, there is no reparation. Furthermore, it is the thief's fault that there is no time for an appeal to the judge that stands over him and me, namely the law. And so I am allowed to make my own defence, and to be at war with the thief, and to kill him if I can. What puts men into a state of nature is the lack of a common judge who has authority. The use of unlawful force against a man's person creates a state of war, whether or not there is a common judge, and, therefore, whether or not they are in a state of nature. But for men in a society under a government, the state of war ends when the actual force ends, and then those on each side of the trouble should equally submit to the fair determination of the law. But in the state of nature, where there are no positive laws or judges with authority to appeal to, once a state of war has begun, it continues, with the innocent party having a right to destroy the other if he can, until the aggressor offers peace and seeks reconciliation on terms that will make up for any wrongs he has done, and will give the innocent person security from then on. What if the situation is like this? There is time and opportunity for an appeal to the law, and to legally constituted judges. But the remedy is not available, because of a manifest perverting of justice, a barefaced twisting of the laws, so that they protect or even reward the violence or injuries perpetrated by some men or some party of men. In such a case, it is hard to think we have anything but a state of war. For wherever violence is used and injury done, even if it is done by people appointed to administer justice and is dressed up in the name, claims, or forms of law, it is still violence and injury. The purpose of the law is to protect and get compensation for the innocent by an unbiased treatment of all who come under it. And when this is not genuinely done, war is made upon the sufferers, and they, having nowhere on earth to appeal to for justice, are left to the only remedy in such cases, an appeal to heaven. In a state of nature where there is no authority to decide between contenders, and the only appeal is to heaven, every little difference is apt to end up in war. And that is one great reason for men to put themselves into society and leave the state of nature. For where there is an authority, a power on earth, from which relief can be had by appeal, the controversy is decided by that power, and the state of war is blocked. Chapter 4. Slavery. The natural liberty of man is to be free from any superior power on earth, and not to be under the will or legislative authority of men, but to be ruled only by the law of nature. The liberty of man in society is to be under no legislative power except the one established by consent in the Commonwealth, and not under the power of any will or under restraint from any law, except what is enacted by the legislature in accordance with its mandate. Freedom, then, is not what Sir Robert Filmer tells us it is, namely a liberty for everyone to do what he wants, live as he pleases, not tied by any laws. Rather, freedom is one of two things. Freedom of nature is being under no restraint except the law of nature. Freedom of men under government involves having a standing rule for everyone in the society to live by, made by the legislative power that has been set up in the society. It is a liberty to follow one's own will in anything that isn't forbidden by that rule, and not to be subject to the inconstant, uncertain, unknown, arbitrary will of another man. This freedom from absolute, arbitrary power is so necessary to a man's survival, so tightly tied to it, that losing it involves losing all control over one's own life. That's why no one can voluntarily enter into slavery. A man doesn't have the power to take his own life, so he can't voluntarily enslave himself to anyone, or put himself under the absolute, arbitrary power of someone else to choose to take away his life. Nobody can give more power than he has. So someone who cannot take away his own life cannot give someone else such a power over it. If someone performs an act that deserves death, he has, by his own fault, forfeited his own life. The person to whom he has forfeited it may delay taking it, and instead make use of the offending man for his own purposes. And this isn't doing him any wrong, because whenever the offender finds the hardship of his slavery to outweigh the value of his life, he has the power to resist the will of his master, thus bringing the death that he wants. What I have been discussing is the condition of complete slavery, which is just a continuation of the state of war between a lawful conqueror and a captive. If they enter into any kind of pact, agreeing to limited power on the one side and obedience on the other, the state of war and slavery ceases for as long as the pact is in effect. For, as I have said, no man can by an agreement pass over to someone else something that he doesn't himself have, namely a power over his own life. I admit that we find among the Jews, as well as other nations, cases where men sold themselves. But clearly they sold themselves only into drudgery, not slavery. It is evident that the person who was sold wasn't thereby put at the mercy of an absolute, arbitrary, despotic power, for the master was obliged at a certain time to let the other go free from his service, so he couldn't at any time have the power to kill him. Indeed, the master of this kind of servant was so far from having an arbitrary power over his life that he couldn't arbitrarily even maim him. The loss of an eye or a tooth set him free. End of chapters 1 through 4.